夫人。
Borealis。
Paradigm
Expansion。
Greetings from the North, citizens of the globe, welcome. Today we return to the subject of system criticism and power analysis as we delve deep into the background of the crime network running the Western world. Many names are named, most rather unknown, exotic or superficially familiar by most, which in itself makes it crucial to drop them, so we can increase our familiarity with the actual players, their networks, and rotten schemes. In short, the gullible and good-willed public has lost control over their own societies long ago, and this snowball from hell has just accelerated so much so that the cat cannot any longer be kept in the bag. As one scandal after another forces itself on the people who, no matter how hard they try to bury their ostrich heads in the ground, no longer has the luxury of blissful ignorance. And of course, also thanks to the modern communication tools like the internet and its scattered pockets of free spaces such as podcasts. In other words, we live in a time where we have unprecedented awareness of the skeletons in the power closet, whether we want to or not. And much thanks to heroes and heroines such as our guest tonight. With this awareness comes responsibility to spread further awareness, to maintain updated, and to support those brave voices which shouts out that the emperor is naked with great risk to themselves. Of course, in this day and age, political or character assassination is more common than bodily liquidation, if nothing else, then precisely because it is less risky for the perpetrators. And our crime overlords are nothing if not cowards, to censor, smear and slander those who dare to speak up, than to go through the nuisance of murder and cover-up, which is a last resort, whether it is done brutally fast as with Seth Rich, or with extended incremental torture as with Julian Assange. Depressing as it is, though, if we do not become aware of our collective shadow, we are trapped by and lost in it. Just as we have an obligation to purge our personal impurities, we also need to battle our group sins. And the power elite is perhaps the most succinct expression of our collective ego, which has run amok. Therefore, pay attention to names, families, networks, methods, and games played by the psychopathic 0.1%ers, because the only thing they fear, which is also the only thing that can deaden them, is scrutiny of their vile affairs, is spotlight on our blackest societal spots, is awareness of the bad in order to course correct and seek good. Here's some of the intrigues we'll be exploring today.
Regarding the genesis of this union of organized crime and intelligence agencies, which is a now declassified operation called Operation Underworld, which involved the Office of Naval Intelligence, some military intelligence, the Office of Strategic Services, or the OSS, which is the precursor to the CIA, and affiliates of the National Crime Syndicate, which is sort of a decentralized, I guess you could say, social network in the pre-big tech sense of sort of a prominent organized crime figures based in the American Northeast. So the FBI, well, they're technically the U.S.'s first domestic intelligence agency, but, you know, this has obviously changed in more recent years. For example, there's now the Department of Homeland Security, which was created in the aftermath of September 11th, 2001, which is another domestic intelligence agency. And in total, the U.S. has now 18 intelligence agencies. So there's quite a lot.
Yeah.
A lot of people think it's a much smaller number, but no, it's around 18 or so.
The FBI is a direct, it started as, actually, they hired, it started as a mafia thing they hired one of the mafia families to clean up against the others. And then they did such a good job that they became elevated eventually to the federal. It was originally the Bureau of Investigation, and eventually they became the Federal Bureau. So they just put this mafia faction as a federal stamp on it, as a have at it, boys. But I guess this is all part of Underworld.
Wow, that's interesting, because I didn't actually get into the origins of the FBI itself in the piece, so I'd definitely be interested to check out what you just mentioned there and maybe add it to a later edition of the book. But what I do talk about quite extensively is the most famous and longest serving director of the FBI, which is J. Edgar Hoover, and his affiliations, rather close affiliations with organized crime, and how he was allegedly entrapped and then involved in a sexual blackmail operation.
Folks, do the math. What do you get if you cross mafia Nazis and the Wall Street fascist elites, Anglo-American elites?
Yeah, you get corporatism disguised as democracy. Yeah,
exactly. With the operative arm CIA. And that's what we get today. And how can people think it's something else than sinister when that's the entire legacy? That's the ingredients of the Frankenstein beast. No, it's worse than that. I was told this. I actually did another Epstein show with someone else, and he told me pretty good info, like you. He told me that, what's the Palantir guy called? The guy from South
Peter
Africa.
Thiel.
Yeah. He seized, it went black. He took over the whole thing. So now
he's particularly obsessed with the whole immortality thing. He backed a startup that was collecting blood from young people to inject into older people to slow the aging process.
Is this the adrenochrome thing?
No, it just sounds it's a startup that's supposed to slow aging, but the whole premise of it is to inject young people, like teenager blood, into your body.
Vampires.
Yeah. So anyway, it sounds very vampire-y. And, you know, if you look at pictures of Peter Thiel speaking, he literally looks like Emperor Palpatine at this point from Star Wars. So
and it sounds like Palantir.
It's obviously not working very well for him, or something else is going on with Peter Thiel. I don't know.
It's spooky. Grown up in apartheid, the values he would get, you know.
Well, he's been pretty open about that he liked that system.
Oh, wow. Huh.
Yeah, Peter Thiel's a trip.
Yeah. By the way, Virginia Islands, they fired the prosecutor there against Epstein to clean up.
Yeah, just a few days after she filed the case.
Yeah, amazing. Now, they called Maxwell the left hand of Epstein, and the mainstream even went as far as to call Brunel the right hand.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair as it relates to the sex trafficking activities. I'll make that clear, because Epstein was involved in much more than that.
And now let me introduce this guest. Whitney Elise Webb has been a professional writer, researcher, and independent journalist since 2016. Originally from Florida, she's lived in North Carolina and Peru, and in 14 eventually relocated to Chile, where ever since she's been a busy mother of two. She attended Pine View High School, which she graduated from in 08, then attended Davidson College, where she studied biology, theology, and art, and graduated with a bachelor degree in 12. In her career, she's written for several renowned independent media outlets, like Ben Swan's Truth in Media, Global Research, the Ron Paul Institute, 21st Century Wire, EcoWatch, the Antimedia, The UNS Review, and Black Agenda Report. Between 17 to 20, she was staff writer and senior investigative reporter for Mint Press News, and she currently writes for The Last American Vagabond and Unlimited Hangout, the latter which she founded and where she also hosts an occasional podcast. Webb is the well-deserved 2019 winner of the Serena Shim Award for Uncompromised Integrity in Journalism. She has made much radio and television appearance and been a frequent guest at many of the big podcasts. To mention some, The Ripple Effect, Jimmy Dore Show, Glenn Beck, Redacted, Valuetainment, Stay Free with Russell Brand, Natalie Brunel, The Tim Dillon Show, Solari Report with Catherine Orson Fitz, and The Real News Network. Through her works, Whitney aims to highlight underreported issues and find common ground between people of different political persuasions regarding corruption, government overreach, the lack of accountability, big tech, intel, and civil liberties. She rigorously digs up documents and quotes from first-hand sources with a steel trap memory, I say bordering on savantism, and a pleasant way of simply reporting and tying everything together. This is what makes her dangerous to the powers that be, as illustrated by the Patreon censorship scandal of March 21, when they blocked Whitney Webb's account with excuse that her reports might dissuade audience from taking preventive measures to fight COVID-19. Pause. Let me translate that for you. If the sheeple get access to any other info than the official propaganda narrative, which of course is fully debunked today as a disgraceful lie, they may execute their free will and right to choose over their own body by rejecting the profitable jab. There, fixed it. The trigger to cancel her was her December 20 article covering the Wellcome Trust extensively. She was told to remove the article from her own website, but instead she deleted her Patreon account. Bravo! And another example, an interview she did with James Corbett shortly thereafter led to the first strike on Corbett's channel. Now she has finally journeyed on to become an author. Her popular book, which we will scratch the surface of today, is the two-volumer called One Nation Under Blackmail, The Sordid Union Between Intelligence and Organized Crime That Gave Rise to Jeffrey Epstein. The overwhelming wealth of mind-blowing information and revelations spilt out in these two volumes is an indictment of the consequences resulting from the nearly century-old relationship between both U.S. and Israeli intelligence and organized criminal networks, known as the National Crime Syndicate. It explores how that nexus between intel and organized crime directly developed the sexual blackmail tactics and networks that would later enable the blackmail up and other crimes of deceased pedophile and sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein. Other books on Epstein focus on the depraved nature of his crimes, his wealth, and his most famous connected friends and acquaintances. This book, in contrast, reveals the extent to which Epstein's activities were state-sponsored through an exploration of his intelligence connections. And finally, to get another gist of where she's coming from, let me quote from Whitney's article, All Roads Lead to Dark Winter. Wall Street and central banks are trying to take ownership of nature and the global commons. Why we are being pushed into a virtual world, the metaverse. These aren't isolated events. Put the pieces together. You'll own nothing and be happy is the beginning, not the end. Today, I'm so happy to announce that we have with us a guest that I've been drooling after for such a long time, and we finally made it. And of course, I'm talking about, because she's big now, the Whitney Webb, the really vacuum cleaner of the dirty affairs among the elites. And you've probably seen her. You American segment of my audience certainly have seen her left and right everywhere these days. And for you Europeans, and especially you Scandinavians, just hold on to your hats, okay? You're going to be in for a wild ride. Welcome to the show, Whitney.
Great to be here. Thanks so much for having me on. Yeah. Sorry it took so long.
Well, and I just did, I don't know if you know, but I did a show with your husband. I didn't even know he was your husband. He was actually my replacement for not getting you.
Oh, well, did you tell him that?
Yes, and he agreed that you are pretty similar in many ways. But I think you are more of a computer than him when it comes to, you know, pulling up dates and
maybe for certain things, I don't know.
Because I've seen you around, you know, I tried to get hold of you before. Now you've exploded, right? After this book, it seems like you're doing interviews every day.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate
it. Once it about 2021 or so, I started getting about 200 emails a day. So my secretary manages that a lot. And while I was doing the book, I also had a baby. Yeah. And a lot of other things happen.
Yeah, that's great.
So I just kind of had to tell her to not, that I couldn't do interviews really, except in a couple, you know, a couple exceptions for people I know really well that have a way of reaching me a different way.
Yeah. No, I tried to get hold of you long ago.
Oh, okay.
Long before everybody, before you were a household name, but I had the wrong mail on you.
Oh.
So I never heard it. I discovered that when I talked with Johnny. But anyway, you're all the way back in Chile. I thought you were like 9 hours behind me, but I just discovered you just a few hours behind me.
Yeah, so time zones are a bit weird, I guess, with South America. So even though Chile looks like, if you look at a standard map, looks like it lines up with something like U.S. Mountain Time or Pacific Time, because of course it is a Pacific coastal country.
Yeah.
It actually, at least during Chilean summer, which is of course now, it's only like 3 hours apart from Spain, Portugal, and the United Kingdom. So, yeah. Smaller world than you think, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. So in a way, you know, in terms of geography, you're far away, but not in terms of time. It's interesting.
Yeah.
So, but you hail from America, obviously.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'll just ask you first before we go into the dirty stuff.
And I'm happy to discuss anything you want.
Yeah. So what made you emigrate to Chile? Do you feel it's safer there?
So I left the U.S. when I was 22, probably just a couple months after I graduated from undergraduate university studies. I was going to do a master's degree at, I got a free ride to do a master's degree at Western Kentucky University, but I dropped out and decided to go to South America because I was just really disillusioned with people my age in the U.S. to like a huge degree, because I was very political then. I mean, pretty much the same views I have now.
I remember you were a Ron Paul supporter, right? Back in the day?
Well, not at the time, really. Is back in 2012. So yeah, that would have coincided with Ron Paul's presidential campaign. But I was more, identifying as an anarchist, I guess, in that period, in the sense that I didn't really find appeal in any of it. I mean, sure, like Ron Paul would have certainly been a better choice than anyone else that ran in a major party in the 2012 election cycle. But I didn't, I wasn't politically active. And I think I actually ended up leaving before that election even happened in 2012. I left, I think, in July or August.
Right.
Of that year. So no, I wasn't really politically active then. I was already pretty disillusioned, I guess you could say, with a lot of different things. And so I ended up taking a job doing some farm management stuff in Peru, and lived in Peru for about 2 years. And then I ended up moving south Chile because my best friend at the time where I was working in Peru was Chilean, and I was kind of tired of different things related to being a foreigner in the Cusco region of Peru. It can get tiring after a while. He recommended I try Chile out, saying it was a sort of a mix between Peru and the West in terms of standards of living, and I might like it better. And at least the south of Chile, I really do like. I do find it to be very relaxed, and people are generally nice. But of course, the whole COVID situation was very extreme here, as it was in other countries. Of course, this is nothing exclusive to Chile. But of course, that changed a lot of things here that I had previously, liked about the country. And, hopefully, if this all gets attempted again, it won't be the same within Chile. But, it's hard to. It's hard to know. So I've ended up staying really because, I have two kids. Both of them were born here. And once you have kids, it becomes a lot harder to country hop.
Yeah, definitely.
So that's part of it. And also, well, post-COVID inflation has hit here pretty hard. But before that, the standard of living was significantly cheaper than it was in the US or even the UK. So that's one of the reasons, too, because at least in the US, having kids is very expensive.
Yeah. I'm totally with you. I plan to actually emigrate to Portugal. It's kind of like the same kind of solution. It's in Southern Europe. So the living standard is decent, but you get so much more back for your money. Like, I live in probably the most expensive country in the world, and I can sit on the South Pole having this show, right? So, as long as I have internet.
Right.
So I'm with you. But, you know, I heard about you through the Ron Paul people back in the day, so I just assumed you were associated. But it makes sense you say you're more anarchistic-oriented. And Argentina, I guess it's fully European. Just beware that.
I've been to Argentina for some reporting, and yeah, so I'm familiar that it's, you know, basically little Italy.
Yeah, be careful, because there's many spider webs down there. So if you get the wrong people,
I'm very aware. But I've written pretty rarely about the region in which I live, though I did get I did do a series for my former employer, Press News, about some weird ongoings in southern Argentina as it relates to a British billionaire named Joe Lewis. Basically created his own personal fiefdom and attempted to murder Argentinians attempting to access the lake he lives nearby, because in Chile and Argentina you can't block the public from accessing large bodies of water, which are considered part of like the commons, like they belong to everybody.
Yeah, same as here.
Yeah.
It's typical for fjord countries. Yeah.
Right. And so he's attempted to basically drown and murder murder them, and has been taking over the government and has built a weird airstrip and that has no oversight even by Argentina's military, and is making weird flights between that base and the Falkland Islands, which of course is a lot of area of contention. He's a British billionaire, right? So there was a Falklands War between Argentina and the United Kingdom in the 80s. So it's a very contentious issue. And one of the locals in the area where this airport is got her house just filled with bullet holes when she reported about some of the stuff going on there on a local radio station. So that's, you know, the one and only time I've really tried to unearth some of the weird stuff going on down here. But just like anywhere, you know, there's weird happenings.
Yeah.
You know, the elite class is attempting to fight for keeps. And so there's a lot of infighting between them over the spoils, I guess you could say, who gets to control which resources and which areas versus others, and sort of dividing up you know, the world as, you know, as they're trying to consolidate power collectively. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff obviously going on here, but, you know, you can name pretty much any region in the world and there'll be something weird going on these days.
Yeah. If there's something to seize, there's always going to be psychopaths who desire that.
Yeah.
But make sure you keep Johnny in a leash, because he's going around investigating the local police. And I actually think it would be more popular hearing this thing you talk about, because I think the general Argentinian will thank you for looking into this. Have you written about this yet, or are you going to do it in the future?
Yeah, I wrote about it a few years ago, but it was in English, not in Spanish.
Right.
So I actually started writing originally in Spanish. I had like a small blog. It's not there anymore, but I used to write about environmental issues in Chile, like critical of the salmon industry down here. Which is just behind Norway, actually. So Norway is the number one global producer of salmon.
Is it as rotten as ours?
Yeah, it's just as bad. Maybe even a little worse, because Norway, being part of the European Union, there's certain chemicals in aquaculture that are prohibited in Norway, but are legal in Chile. And so there's attempts to exploit that here. And The year I was writing about it, there was a particularly bad red tide issue in Chile, which was never recorded as even happening, I think, until the late 70s, which is, of course, when a lot of the salmon industry started to explode in Chile under the Pinochet regime.
Yeah.
And this particular year I was writing about it, one of the large salmon fisheries, which operates, you know, off the coast of an area here in the south, had a large amount of salmon die. And instead of removing the bodies of the dead salmon from the ocean, just let them rot. So it caused like a massive nitrogen explosion. And they tried to blame it all on climate change and global warming and stuff. But if you have a million dead fish rotting in the ocean and red tide, you know, appears in the same spot because of a nitrogen bloom, I mean, it's pretty, pretty clear what likely exacerbated it relative to other years. Right. So
I'll not waste time trashing Norway's horrible situation. It's I could go on with stories like this. So,
I can imagine.
Your time is godly precious. So we'll just. But here's the thing. Sufficient to say I'm a health nut on my late days, and I never touch salmon. I love fish. I never touch salmon. And unless it's wild, we have mountains, right? So you can catch it yourself in the wild. But that goes for all game.
Yeah, I mean, same here, but it's uncommon. Almost all salmon you're going to get is the farmed stuff. And actually, the salmon company I was mentioning earlier that let all those bodies, salmon, dead salmon rot, was actually owned by a major Norwegian salmon conglomerate. Yeah,
makes sense. Makes sense. No, that's totally in line with those psychopaths. Don't you have organic salmon farms, though?
Not that I'm aware of. So usually when it comes to like organic stuff, a lot of Chilean companies that like to claim they're organic go through the USDA certification process, which is unusual, right? Because there's Chile has its equivalent of the USDA that's called SAG, S-A-G, and they have their own sort of organic thing, but I think once in my 12 years here, I've seen it on a product in Chile. But the USDA one's more common.
Because it's probably not as easy to buy. Yeah, the American one is easy to buy, Perkis probably.
Yeah, but it's costly because it's an international certification process. Like, it's not based in Chile. So in my experience, a lot of the salmoneras, as they're called here, don't participate.
Okay.
They're very dirty in general. I mean, wherever they end up, they invariably dump waste they shouldn't in rivers and lakes. I mean, it's a major issue down here. So, as I'm sure it is in Norway.
It is. But like I said, we have to move on. Now, today I wanted to mainly focus on, I mean, this is a prelude of the dirt that is to come. We're just going to change scenarios, right?
Yeah.
So I'm going to do book one with you today. You have, for those who don't know, made two books, part one and part two. The angle is the Epstein story, but he just serves to kind of crystallize. It's kind of good because it will catch people's attention. I think it's easier, actually, to write such a book now with that angle than if Epstein didn't exist. Because with Epstein, they can get like a personification of the whole goddamn thing. Mm-hmm. But it's so much bigger than Epstein, like you're going to hear, folks. And part one is the one I'm really stoked about because we've been delving in a lot in World War II and some of the stuff going on there. And I know you begin even before World War II, but I definitely want to pick your brain for that period, the 40s and I guess also 50s. By the way, Bormann lived in your vicinity at that time. So did a lot of other, as you know, of course, exile Nazis. And some of them were behaving like this British billionaire. Mengele is a famous example. And I want to also pause a little around the Iran-Contras scandal. I guess that's covered in book one, too.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's chapters, I believe, 7 and 8.
Yeah.
It's a 10-chapter book, volume one.
10-chapter. Now, full disclosure, I haven't read a book yet. I'm obviously gonna. But I can wing it. I know a lot about these things. And besides, although we usually do conversational interviews, I'll shut more up today and let you be more free roaming.
sure.
But I'm going to use the contents list from Amazon as a guide for this talk. So how far back do you want to rewind this? Because I'm sure we could go really far back if we didn't have the book as a guide.
Well, there's a couple different starting points. So where I start off the book is what I sort of pinpoint mainly for ease of the reader as a what I would argue is one of the main genesis or events regarding the genesis of this union of organized crime and intelligence agencies, which is a now declassified operation called Operation Underworld, which involved the Office of Naval Intelligence, some military intelligence, the Office of Strategic Services, or the OSS, which is the precursor to the CIA, and affiliates of the National Crime Syndicate, which is sort of a decentralized, I guess you could say, social network in the pre-big tech sense of sort of a prominent organized crime figures based in the American Northeast. But before even getting there, it's worth, you know, I that's where I start chapter one, but then I go back even further in chapter four to talk about New York and organized crime in New York, even before Operation Underworld, which again took place during World War II. So in the 1940s, you know, a couple decades before then, I talk about how organized crime in New York specifically decided to take over the unions as a way to take over the Democratic Party, which in New York and throughout the U.S. historically, particularly in this period, counted the unions as its, you know, essentially its power base, like a lot of labor parties, left-leaning parties throughout the Western world have tended to have a similar model. So by corrupting the unions and then by installing certain key officials, usually through death threats, among other things, in terms of like vote counting in certain precincts and different you know, key positions in the electoral process, they were essentially able to take over the Democratic Party. So by the time you have Operation Underworld happening, the mayor of New York is a close associate of the notorious gangster Frank Costello, which is one of the two figures that the novel and subsequent movie The Godfather, Don Corleone, that character is based on, and eventually had to be removed from his position as mayor of New York and was protected by the Democratic president at the time, Harry Truman, who essentially gave him diplomatic immunity by appointing him ambassador to Mexico while he was under active investigation for unorganized crime affiliation and corruption. So, you know, this is something that goes much deeper than Operation Underworld. But if we're talking about organized crime and intelligence getting together, you know, that particular event saw these intelligence agencies sort of the foundation for what would become the U.S. national security state, actively seeking to work with a union controlled and essentially owned by organized crime for the purpose of obtaining, quote unquote, intelligence, meaning information about alleged saboteurs on the New York dock. And again, this whole pretext, this idea that there were saboteurs in the dock and all of this, and the impetus behind Operation Underworld, a lot of this is actually British intelligence. And if you look at the creation of the OSS itself, for example, you have figures like William Stevenson and other people very much tied up with British intelligence who were very instrumental in the creation of those entities. You have people like the head of the OSS, Bill Donovan, also having a considerable amount of connections to the British aristocracy and intelligence. Because, of course, in Britain, the British intelligence agencies historically have been populated with members of the British elite and aristocracy. And it's not different at all in the United States, where a lot of the early leaders and recruits for the OSS and later the CIA are, you know, plucked from, you know, wealthy families or, you know, family people that, you know, work on Wall Street, lawyers for big banks. People intimately tied to some of the more American oligarch clans that have, you know, been prominent since the 19th century. The Rockefellers being a big example, but also the Mellons and JP, the Morgans, you know.
Vanderbilt.
The Vanderbilts, right. So there's like a lot of these families like that. So you find a lot of overlap between the early recruits of these agencies in America with these particular oligarch clans and the people that relatively, you know, directly serve them. So at that point, you know, you can see that American intelligence is essentially, you know, the CIA, right? In that context, it's useful to sort of look at them in a sense as the secret police of the U.S. oligarchy, yeah, or U.S. capital, in terms of the oligarchy controls an outsized portion of capital. And, you know, a lot of the people in prominent positions in these agencies are people directly affiliated with these oligarch clans and, you know, influential and wealthy organizations, a lot of them banks.
But let me ask you this. How did the organized crime and when approximately did that rise to such an extent that it became a power factor? And when did, and I'm going to talk America here, and when did the intelligence, because OSSE was just a skeleton of what it became. Today, it's the most major player in the world scene, and people don't even know it.
Sure.
But they have to have risen, and I know they converged during the underworld, so touch on that too. Before we move on.
Right. So organized crime in the U.S. Really came to be a dominant player sometime in the 1920s. And a lot of this was directly related, not just to what I mentioned earlier about them taking over unions and thus the Democratic Party, but also through prohibition policy. So for mm-hmm. people not familiar with that, that was the illegalization of alcohol during much of the 1920s in the United States. And despite that, you know, the federal ban, there was still a significant amount of illegal smuggling of alcohol into the United States. And a lot of the people involved in quote unquote bootlegging or that act of smuggling are organized crime, members of organized crime or affiliates of organized crime to a very significant degree. And again, you have the involvement of Britain and groups like in Canada that are, you know, very much linked up with Britain, involved in this, like the Hudson Bay Company. In the book, I talk about some Winston Churchill connections to all of these networks that are pretty significant. But more often than not, it tends to be organized crime, most specifically people that are affiliates or members of the Jewish mob. So it's important to keep in mind in the context of saying that for much of the time that organized crime was prominent and forming in the United States from the early 20th century to around, you know, the 60s or so, organized crime was really in ethnic enclaves. So you'd have the Italian mafia, the Jewish mob, you'd have Irish organized crime, and, you know, they'd be sort of siloed. By ethnicity. And so what happened, the group I mentioned earlier, this National Crime Syndicate, was essentially a marriage between the Jewish mob and the Italian mafia, because the architects of this, which was Lucky Luciano on the Italian side and Mayor Lansky.
Yeah, that's even featured in The Godfather.
Yeah. But Mayor Lansky was on the Jewish side. And so Lansky and Luciano were childhood friends. And so they had, of course, through their friendship and experience in transcending this ethnic enclave model. So they realized that they could collectively expand their power and influence by teaming up and breaking down that ethnic model, essentially. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't really stay that way forever, because ultimately what happens is that Lucky Luciano is arrested. And some of this is related to things that happened with Operation Underworld. But he's subsequently, after being arrested, he's let out early because of his role in aiding U.S. intelligence during the war. But he's deported to Italy. And essentially, a lot of the assets of him and his affiliates Most direct affiliates in the Italian mafia are somewhat absorbed by Mayor Lansky and his associates, who go on in a very fundamental way to dominate organized crime on the West Coast, particularly in places like Las Vegas through Bugsy Siegel, for example. And then out in Los Angeles, people like Lou Wasserman, who later becomes a major Hollywood mogul and political kingmaker in the U.S., for example, one of the main forces behind Ronald Reagan, also a backer of Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, and George Bush Sr., oddly enough, with very significant organized crime connections going back to these networks. So ultimately, a lot of the Italian side of this ends up being moved over to Europe, where they, again, later collaborate with U.S. intelligence even more, including with things...
Were they involved in Propaganda Due, that scandal? Do you know?
What scandal is that?
P2, the P2 in Italy.
Oh, the P2 up. Lodge, yeah. with the Pope and stuff?
Lizio Gale.
So I've never really studied that extensively myself, the P2 Masonic Lodge in Italy. But that
was CIA, Nazis, and these Masons.
Yeah. So, you know, unfortunately, I don't cover a lot of this in the book. I do think I make passing mention of P2 in the context of some of these networks.
Right.
But I didn't really get into that too much, unfortunately.
That's okay. But I know there was mafia involved, so they probably were.
Well, there were a lot of period, Operation Gladio, for example. You have sort of organized crime, the Vatican and the CIA all working together. And so you have a lot of these operations over the years, once this fusion between organized crime and U.S. intelligence takes place. So you have, you know, that happening with the Jewish mob in the United States, and then later with the creation of the State of Israel, a lot of those same elements, including Mayor Lansky, Bugsy Siegel, the Bromf family, and others are very significant patrons of Israel's national security apparatus from its creation onward. So at that point, the Jewish mob in the U.S. becomes significantly transnational. And, you know, it expands after that point. But then you have the Italian aspect of it, you know, become very active in Italy itself, and then, you know, aiding U.S. intelligence operations in Europe and allegedly in the Middle East.
Yeah. Sorry to budge in here, but from now and then I'll just butt in.
It's fine.
But to such an extent, folks, that in the 70s, Europe, and it's for the benefit of the American listeners, were ridden with terrorism actions. And some of it was so-called right-wing, some of it was like left-wing, but the left-wing things, it turns out, were usually CIA moves. Even this famous, was it Red Brigade? I forgot what they were called, those in Italy, but it's come to known the last 10 years or something that, it was all an up to, you know, drive people away from Soviet sympathy. Amazing, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I think honestly, when you consider the fact that a lot of these intelligence operations, a lot of information is declassified roughly 70 years or so in accordance with U.S. law after these operations are conducted, it tends to be that around that period of time, you know, by the time all the people actually actively involved are dead, you know, we start to see the actual information about what really happened and what our history, you know, actually is, and what the history of our, you know, at least in the U.S., the national U.S. national security state is. And unfortunately, even despite the declassification of a lot of these documents, there's no effort by mainstream media or, you know, the curriculums in U.S. schools or universities to convey this information to the public. It essentially remains isolated, and only those interested in going to look up, you know, declassified documents on certain databases or Freedom of Information Act requests, among other things, you know, end up engaging with this information at all, which is pretty significant in the sense that, you know, most Americans have no idea what the history of our intelligence agencies are abroad or even domestically, right?
Yeah, and CIA isn't even supposed to operate internally, right?
Yeah, but I think everyone that has bothered to look even a little bit at the CIA is aware that that is very untrue.
Yeah. And of course, FBI, I think you were the one who taught me that. I learned that recently. It may have been from one of your interviews that they actually...
Yeah.
Yeah, go on.
So the FBI... Well, they're technically the U.S.'s first domestic intelligence agency, but you know, this has obviously changed in more recent years. For example, there's now the Department of Homeland Security, which was created in the aftermath of September 11th, 2001, which is another domestic intelligence agency. And in total, the U.S. has now 18 intelligence agencies. So there's quite a lot.
Yeah,
a lot of people think it's a much smaller number, but no, it's around 18 or so.
But FBI is a direct. It started as actually they hired. No, it was another guy I had. He said that it started as a mafia thing. They hired one of the mafia families to clean up against the others. And then they did such a good job that they became elevated eventually to the federal. It was originally the Bureau of investigation, and eventually they became the federal bureau. So they just put this mafia faction as a federal stamp on it and said, have at it, boys. But I guess this is all part of...
Well, that's interesting because I didn't actually get into the origins of the FBI itself in the piece. So I'd definitely be interested to check out what you just mentioned there and maybe add it to a later edition of the book. But what I do talk about quite extensively is the most famous and longest serving director of the FBI, which is J. Edgar Hoover, and his affiliations, rather close affiliations with organized crime, and how he was allegedly entrapped and then involved in a sexual blackmail operation that involved Louis Rosenstiel, who's one of these organized crime, specifically Jewish mob-linked bootleggers from Prohibition that later becomes a major baron of the American liquor industry through Shenley Industries, which later gets sold to Rapid American Corporation several decades down the line. And then Roy Cohn, who's most widely remembered today in the U.S. as a organized crime lawyer, sort of a defense lawyer for gangster figures, as well as the mentor to former President Donald Trump. But in this particular context, he was involved in a sexual blackmail operation that involved underage boys. It appears to have been based at the New York Plaza Hotel, or at least utilized a suite in that particular hotel, which not that long after Roy Cohn's death is purchased and taken over by Donald Trump and has its own allegedly nefarious associations at that point in time. Mm-hmm. But for the context of J. Edgar Hoover, he was allegedly sexually blackmailed by the mob, by affiliates of Mayor Lansky.
I mean, he was a sitting duck in terms of blackmail because of the cross-dressing and whatnot.
Yeah, and being a closeted homosexual in a period of time where that would end your political career, right?
Yeah.
So there was actually, alongside the Red Scare, the McCarthy era, where, again, Roy Cohn was chief counsel to Joseph McCarthy.
Right.
During that period, there was a parallel event called the Lavender Scare, which was about, instead of hunting communists in the government, it was about hunting closeted gay men in the government. And the reason for this, ironically enough, was that those men could be easily blackmailed because of the contentious nature of their sexuality at that time. But actually, the people that were running the Red and Lavender Scares, essentially, not necessarily McCarthy himself, but Roy Cohn as chief counsel, you know, that's obvious. Obviously a key connection there, are involved in sexual compromise operations targeting gay men. And of course, Roy Cohn is well known as having been a closeted gay man during this period and far beyond as well. And Louis Rosenstiel was well known at his factories, among other places, for what was referred to as one author as bisexual antics. You know, so it's pretty well documented. And there's other people that have, attested to this behavior on J. Edgar Hoover. But ultimately, the idea that he was blackmailed by elements of organized crime explains why he was about to leave his post at the FBI. He denied that organized crime had any influence or power in the United States and failed to prosecute them in any meaningful way as head of the FBI, which of course allowed organized crime to become very much entrenched, not just in terms of the U.S. political system, but also corporate America and with our intelligence community. So it got really out of control. So you could say that there's a lot to be said about J. Edgar Hoover's lack of action and the reasons behind it. And it's also worth saying that these pictures that were taken by affiliates of Mayor Lansky were later obtained by James Jesus Angleton, who's the CIA's counterintelligence chief during this particular period. And he's, you know, quite notorious in his own right. And he, him receiving these photographs showing Hoover engaged in homosexual activity is one of many examples of this relatively early period in the early 50s where you have organized crime and the CIA collaborating in the collection of quote unquote intelligence, which again, intelligence is ultimately just like information that can be useful, right?
Yeah, but blackmail, basically.
Which includes blackmail, yes.
Yeah, no, we've been a lot in the 50s here. I just want to wrap up the 30s and 40s. And I've learned in your interview with Redacted, or it was Jimmy Dore show, that the Project Underworld was actually an official title for the merging of intelligence and mafia. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah, so Operation Underworld was the official name. That's not anything I supplied. That's their name for it. They fully knew what they were doing, but they justified it as, you know, this is war. So this is, you know, a necessity solely because we're in a state of war and we have to do absolutely everything in our power to win the war we are in, right? That's justification. But then, of course, the war ends and the symbiosis continues and actually deepens. And so if you're, for example, looking at the early history of the CIA in the early post-war period, you will invariably find that on many, if not most, CIA assassination squads, among, you know, other teams within the CIA, they're mob guys.
Yeah, when they assassinated Ernesto Che Guevara, it was actually Klaus Barbie who did it, together with this connection guy. You probably know his name. This, I guess he's exiled Cuban. He was involved in the JFK thing.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. He's been everywhere for assassinations. And this, there's an aspect here. Yes, they're merging mafia and intelligence, but they're also merging off in the 45 and onwards. They're also merging Nazis and intelligence. So you have this unholy triangle of CIA, Nazis and mobsters, right?
Right. So really quick on that point, what I think is important to point out in light of what you have just said is organized crime network I'm talking about here, overwhelmingly supportive of European fascism right before and during World War II. And then you look at people, for example, one of the most famous early CIA directors, Alan Dulles. Alan Dulles, as a station, one of the European station chiefs for the OSS during the war, was actively involved in actually attempting to subvert U.S. government policy by trying to get amnesty for top Nazi officials, among other policies that would essentially, prevent any sort of punishment of major corporations, major banks that were involved in financing the Nazi war effort or supporting it by other means, to sort of prevent anything from happening to them. And a lot of, prominent officials or wealthy businessmen that supported Hitler and things like that, there was efforts on his part to essentially get amnesty for them. So it's no surprise that you eventually have things like Operation Paperclip, where the national security community, including, you know, what becomes the CIA, is involved in, you know, bringing Nazi scientists who should have been charged and probably murdered at the Nuremberg trials and in the aftermath, instead are brought to the U.S. and are involved in creating the U.S. national security state in the post-war era, and major scientific agencies of the United States government, like NASA, among other entities. And on the organized crime front, for example, Frank Costello's, one of his big backers was a guy named, it's Generoso Pope. And Generoso Pope was the big cement guy in New York. And he became that way because of his mob connections. He got all the city contracts and then became the biggest a cement company in New York, and then later the country. Colonial Sand and Stone was the name of his company. But he also essentially controls the entire Italian vote in New York by controlling all of the prominent Italian language newspapers. And he was an ardent supporter of Mussolini, as were people like Frank Costello, Lucky Luciano, and others. Despite the fact that, as I mentioned earlier, Luciano is basically like helping the Americans and intelligence and all of this stuff, they like the ideology of these guys, right? So it's not a surprise that they all end up coming together, because it's in their interest to sort of see, you know, what Mussolini defined as fascism, you know, is sometimes referred to as corporatism, this merging of the public and private sector. And so for organized crime, yeah, that benefits them. It also benefits a lot of these, you know, intelligence agencies. If you consider what I mentioned earlier, how a lot of them are essentially the secret police for private capital. So why would they not also like that corporatist model? They essentially typify it themselves. So you end up seeing this merging, not just of organized crime and intelligence, but you see a lot of corporations get in the mix here. A big example would be United Fruit Company, for example. So United Fruit Company is allegedly involved in aspects of the failed Bay of Pigs invasion. They're a major reason why the CIA overthrew the democratically elected.
Hello? Hello? Damn. If you can hear me, you've disappeared, Whitney.
Hello?
Can you hear me? Yeah.
Yeah, I can hear you fine. Can you hear me now?
You disappeared.
You can hear me now, right?
Yeah, now I can hear you.
Yeah, I could hear you fine the whole time. I don't really know what happened. Sorry about that. I'll stop my video and let's see.
Let's see what happens.
Okay, can you still hear me?
Yeah. So the last thing I heard was CIA.
Okay, but in which context? I was talking about United Fruit?
Yeah.
Did you hear that?
You can take it from there.
Okay, so another one of these companies that gets sort of in the intelligence fold is United Fruit Company. So they were one of the main reasons that the CIA overthrew the democratically elected government of Guatemala in 1954, because that Guatemalan government had moved to nationalize the banana industry, which obviously is going to hurt United Fruit Company's profits in the country. So there's an overthrow there. And then later on, the United Fruit Company gets involved with, you know, acting at times as a CIA front, which included its involvement in the Bay of Pigs invasion. And it ends up actually later falling into the hands, that particular company, of the business mentors of Leslie Wexner, who, of course, is Jeffrey Epstein's main benefactor and has his own very deep ties to both organized crime and Israeli intelligence, specifically in the case of Leslie Wexner. So you have a very interesting mix there of corporate America. You know, United Fruit's just one example. There's a lot of other companies that sort of straddled these worlds in much the same way. And so what I'm trying to show here by talking about this ultimately is that a lot of people mentally see intelligence agencies as entities unto themselves, same with organized crime, and same with multinational corporations or the private sector, the corporate, the college of corporations that are most influential, when in reality there are a lot of links between them all. It's really a web of connections. And so they're really not isolated bodies unto themselves, right? They're continually collaborating and working together. And ultimately, when we get to something like Iran-Contra, you have people in the CIA that turn whistleblowers about the events of Iran-Contra, and they say things like the group responsible for this, which self-identified, for example, as the Enterprise, which is a fitting name because it is a business, right? Mm-hmm. Described the structure of the Enterprise as being ex officio mafia, prominent people in the CIA and other intelligence agencies, CEOs, bankers, people of this nature, sort of, it sounds sort of like a weird mix of people. And then he goes on to say they own media companies and all of this stuff, airlines, what have you, and it becomes rather instructive on how these covert worlds merge and operate, because it's not the way it tends to not be the way most people think of it. So one of the reasons I tried to cram so much detail into volume one is that I just, well, one reason is I wanted it to be really fact heavy, because, you know, if I'm inserting my analysis, you know, people may discount that, but if it's fact after fact after fact and in a particular narrative, it becomes hard to write it off as a coincidence, and becomes very clear that over time these same networks, particularly enabled by, you know, a very robust offshore financial system, essentially not just take over, you know, the U.S. intelligence apparatus, but also, you know, much of Wall Street and, you know, the U.S. government and corporate America. And I mean, it gets really crazy at certain points. And they're very convinced that they're above the law even today. So,
yeah, this is your
not sure where you want to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is your MO, fact of the fact, and obviously footnotes and references. So nobody,
because it's heavily referenced, the book.
Mm-hmm. It has to be, right? Otherwise, they're going to shoot you down immediately.
Yeah.
These so-called fact checkers, right? They're going to try to twist stuff.
Sure.
But I want to add a couple of things before we move on to the Iran-Contras more. First off, for the life of me, I can't remember the name of this. I think it was Cuban. He was the connection between CIA and the Cuban mafia, and he was involved in JFK, and he was, you know, Klaus Barbie was heading the CIA operation to take out, like I mentioned, Guevara, and Klaus Barbie was also the middleman between the Medellin cartel and the CIA. So already back in that day, it was in the 40s and 50s and 60s, they were all coagulating.
Yeah, this network had established themselves by this point, and they maintained and deepened that collaboration through the years. So again, going back to Iran-Contra, for example, Iran-Contra is really the name for what is a much larger scandal that, in my opinion, encompasses the sister scandals, I guess you could say, of the Promise software scandal and the BCCI scandal. And, oh man, I forgot where I was going with that based on what you just said.
But hang on to that thought, because I want to say something that's before that. And that's
the cartels. Sorry, go on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. I want to talk about the Nazis, because you mentioned Operation Paperclip and it's even mainstream people know about this now. But what's less known and belongs in this story, because it kind of substantiates the rest of your perspective, is that it wasn't just Nazi scientists they shipped over. They also shipped over two other factions of resourceful and top Nazis. Number one was the whole German banking cartel, Nazis who had taken that over in the 30s and 40s. So all these banking and corporations, many of them powerful, seated in Argentina, even before the war. And the third very important part of this equation is the spy networks. They didn't touch the spy networks. In fact, they elevated what's his name again? This Nazi spy chief to become the NATO spy head, Galen.
Right.
That's his name. Mm-hmm. Right. And they also kept in place all the Nazis had great spy networks in the 30s and 40s.
Yeah. Well, you know, you have to keep in mind that a lot of the aristocracy, not just in Europe, but also in the U.S., were very supportive of Hitler until war broke out.
Yeah.
And then you have the fact that even during the war, not to pick on Alan Dulles, but for example, he was very supportive of Hitler's idea of a greater Germany, because he saw that as a major challenge to the power of Russia. Right. Yeah, or the Soviet Union. Yeah. And so then, you know, the idea of putting an ex-Nazi in charge of, you know, major aspects of NATO is directly related to that type of policy vision.
Yeah. So we see here, I mean, folks, do the math. What do you get if you cross mafia Nazis and the Wall Street fascist elites, Anglo-American elites?
You get corporatism disguised as democracy. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. With the operative arm CIA. And that's what we get today. And how can people think it's something else than sinister when that's the entire legacy? That's the ingredients of the Frankenstein beast. Okay, so let's move up the timeline. Now, we don't have, you know, get a book if you want all the details. It's packed with details. But let's move up to now Iran-Contras, because I learned about this coincidentally long time ago. It was a human rights lawyer who held a lecture for 6 hours. And I didn't know anything back then. So I was shocked. I thought, this is like another world. And he went into detail after detail and the ramifications. And it's huge. And you and me, we can't do it justice today. But you can mention some of the highlights of what that entire thing sure. was all about. Start with the timeline. When did it happen?
So really, Iran-Contra started to be put in motion, I guess you could say, in the early 80s. You could argue it had its antecedents even before then, really in the Carter administration, where you're having the policies of the Carter administration rub people that had been in the CIA for a long time the wrong way. So you have very prominent people in the CIA, for example, Theodore Shackley essentially splits off from the CIA in the 70s and creates what he calls the his private CIA. That he's essentially running a private intelligence apparatus that later ends up playing a significant role in some of the aspects of Iran-Contra. So when Bill Casey, William Casey, who was previously in the OSS and has a very long history with Wall Street banks and corporate America, he, as a lawyer...
Was he somehow connected to Dulles, who had a finger in every pie going on?
I believe so, but I'd have to go back and look at the specifics of that, because, you know, Casey sort of had he was a career intelligence guy. He tried to get in to be CIA director the first time under the Nixon administration, and it didn't go well. And so in the times that he wasn't in government, he sort of had this revolving door relationship between, you know, his corporate law practice you know, his work in intelligence, right? And he was also during the Nixon administration, not CIA director, but SEC, head of the SEC, the Security and Exchange Commission. Mm. And he had to end up leaving that because of some major controversies with a very insane criminal guy named Robert Vesco, financial criminal guy, that had some major conflicts of interest with Casey himself, who came under investigation by the SEC. But anyway, Bill Casey becomes Reagan's CIA director in 1981, when Reagan takes office, and Casey had previously run Reagan's successful 1980 presidential campaign.
Wow.
And he's joined some of the people he worked most closely with on that campaign was Roy Cohn, who we've already talked about, and a guy named Robert Keith Gray, who is another specialist in sexual blackmail, specifically for the CIA, involved in a 1982 page boy scandal, it's referred to, which involved a congressman having illicit relationships with teenagers, among other things. It gets buried relatively quickly because his best friend Bill Casey is, of course, CIA director by that point. But anyway, these are the types of people that are working very closely with Casey on this particular campaign. And so in the early 1980s, and once he's CIA director, William Casey starts to set up a support apparatus for the Contras in Nicaragua, who are, you know, a network, I guess, of right-wing paramilitary groups that are challenging the power of the Sandinista movement that removed the Somoza family dictatorship that had historically been backed by the U.S. From their, you know, control of Nicaragua. And so this is obviously an effort to bring Nicaragua back into the U.S. dominated fold. And so essentially what happened is that William Casey ran into lots of obstacles with this effort to fund the Contras, mainly because of Congress. So there was a point where Congress declined to finance lethal aid to the Contras, just humanitarian.
Of course, they were ruthless terrorists.
Yeah, a lot of these groups backed by the U.S. and Latin America have historically been that. Yeah. Colombia is another good example. El Salvador.
Insane.
I mean, there's a very dirty, horrific history of these groups that have been more often than not backed by the U.S. or more broadly speaking, the West and Latin America. Yeah. So that was one of the reasons Congress sought to essentially tie Casey's hands about what he could and could not send the Contras. So what does Bill Casey decide to do? He decides, okay, so how about I find a way to finance this type of operation off the books so I don't have to go and ask Congress for money? And so ultimately, you could argue then from what develops out of that, that ultimately Iran-Contra began as an effort to basically create a black budget and black operation apparatus that was completely unaccountable to anyone. You could also argue that that already existed with the CIA before this point.
Yeah.
But obviously, you know, there was a reason that Bill Casey decided to expand that type of activity at such scale with Iran-Contra. And so ultimately, it's beyond the Contras. What he was seeking to do was establish a way for the CIA to finance itself in the conduction of, you know, black ops or covert operations, not just with the Contras, but anywhere in the world for any purpose without congressional or executive oversight. That's essentially the goal here. So
what's the Iran part?
Well, we'll get there. So essentially these modes of financing those efforts become principally drug trafficking and arms trafficking. So there's two different theaters of Iran-Contra. One is in the Middle East with the Reagan administration's efforts. And this is really U.S. and Israeli intelligence collaborating on all of these aspects of Iran-Contra we're going to be talking about. But, you know, at this period of time, there is the Iran-Iraq war going on. There was an interest on the part of Israeli intelligence and also the U.S., which liked neither of these governments at the time, really, but like hated Iran more, I guess you could say, right?
Yeah.
After the revolution, to have them meet each other.
And Saddam was their man anyway, so.
Yeah. So they wanted both sides to they liked the war because they have both of these states weakening each other. And so they're funding and arming both sides. But there was an arms embargo to Iran,
like Russia, Ukraine. Yeah.
Right. So but there was an arms embargo to Iran because of the 1979 revolution and the hostage crisis and all of that stuff. Right. Yeah, so what the U.S. intelligence was doing at that time and allowing Iran to be armed was illegal. And they were doing this with Israel.
So let's also add that they wanted Reagan in instead of Carter. So they asked the... Yeah,
there was a lot of very insane things going on make it so. Yes. And of course, you have things...
Don't let go the American hostages. Wait to after the election, etc. Right. Go on.
Right. And this is the idea of the October surprise, which then involves people like Robert Keith Gray, Bill Casey, and a lot of the same actors that are later involved in the Iran-Contra stuff. And some people see Iran-Contra and October surprise as essentially part of the same thing. And it's not necessarily an inaccurate argument to make. So so you have this particular theater with arms trafficking, right, of arming both Iran and Iraq. And it's not just, of course, the U.S. and Israel. You also have sort of the involvement of the U.K. to an extent in it as well. For example, Margaret Thatcher's son, Mark Thatcher, was involved with arms deals to this effect. And a key figure in this particular theater of Iran-Contra is Adnan Khashoggi. So Adnan Khashoggi, of course, is well known as being a Saudi born arms dealer, but he has connections to pretty much every intelligence agency at this point in time. So he's a very interesting player, and notably in this period of time, his client he took on as he's being tasked by Bill Casey to help set up this theater of Iran-Contra, and specifically the flow of weapons involving the U.S., Israel, and Iran. One of his clients is one of Jeffrey Epstein's early clients after Jeffrey Epstein leaves Bear Stearns. We can get back to that in a moment, because it appears that Epstein himself was involved in some significant aspects of Iran-Contra as well, specifically the financial flow stuff. And that's why I'm sort of hinting so much about the idea of Iran-Contra ultimately going back to illicit finance, money laundering, and the offshore financial system. So the other theater then of Iran-Contra is between is in the Americas, right? So you have Southern Air Transport, the CIA-linked airline being involved in drug trafficking and Contra support efforts that were as far as Congress and the U.S. was concerned, illegal, among other things. And this gets exposed when, you know, a certain airplane involved in a lot of this illicit activity is shot down in Nicaragua, and the pilot is captured and says all this stuff, and it starts to unravel pretty quickly from there.
Yeah.
But it seems so what you had going on in the Latin American, or rather American theater, was a move of arms and also training of Contras, the arming and training of Contras. You also have the movement of drugs. So a lot of these groups like the Contras and some of these other paramilitary groups in Latin America pay for their paid, you know, the CIA and these other, you know, entities for the weapons and training and all of that with drugs. And so those drugs are then brought back into the U.S. You know, there's a lot of money laundering. And then there's the controversies around the drug stuff as it relates to what was going on, for example, in Mena, Arkansas in the time. And some of the stuff written about Gary Webb and in Dark Alliance, obviously, which involves basically the importation of large amounts of crack cocaine as an effort to weaken urban Black communities.
Right.
And I actually talk about in volume two how it seems like Iran-Contra, definitely involving Epstein at this time, was actually during that same period funneling weapons from China, China's military industrial complex after the importation of Chinese weapons was banned in the U.S. Into the same urban Black communities to exacerbate gang violence.
Right.
So we'll save that for our volume two conversation.
Yeah, we'll save that for part two.
Yeah.
But last thing before the last thing for part one, I think it's incumbent upon us to also focus on how this culture, or I should say strategy, of blackmailing rose in this period, because that's really, you know, Epstein, apart from being an economical player, the spy part of it is also control files, right? So could you just speak to this, how this, so maybe an example or two about how this became like the norm of what they were doing, control people.
What became the norm exactly? The financial stuff?
Well, this blackmailing, because people don't understand how everyone is compromised one way or the other.
Right. So what happened, so a lot of the people I talk about in the context of sex blackmail before Iran-Contra, you know, it's typical sex blackmail operation, pinhole cameras, evidence is filmed, and then the person is blackmailed and thus controllable. What happens in a very significant way in the 1980s is sort of this tandem scandal with Iran-Contra that involves U.S. Israeli intelligence and the drug cartels of Latin America, called the Promise Software scandal, which basically was a allowed Israeli intelligence to have a back door to nearly every intelligence agency in the world because of this software called Promise was essentially corrupted by these intelligence agencies and had a back door inserted into it. So then any device that has that installed onto it is accessible to these intelligence agencies. And this was the main salesman of Promise for Israel was Ghislaine Maxwell's father, Robert Maxwell, who was an Israeli spy. So, but then you have the CIA version of Promise, which was collaborative. Israel was selling to national security agencies with their backdoored version of Promise. The CIA puts in their own backdoor, but instead of trying to market it to national security agencies, they market it to banks, to the financial system. And according to the person who originally created Promise and who it was stolen from for the purpose of its corruption in this in these ways, he said the thing Promise was meant to do is track people and track money. So you have the track people side is, you know, being run by Israel, essentially, and Israeli intelligence. And then U.S. intelligence is running the tracking money side. And this is being used to hide and you know, and find looted money, which oddly enough is how Jeffrey Epstein described his intelligence-linked activities in the 1980s, describing himself as a financial bounty hunter, and his main client is Adnan Khashoggi, who's engaged in this exact same type of activity with these people. Oddly enough, the same time that Adnan Khashoggi becomes Jeffrey Epstein's client, as Iran-Contra's being set up in 1982, roughly, he also becomes the client of Robert Keith Gray and Roy Cohn. Pretty weird, huh? And there's a weird Jeffrey Epstein, Bear Stearns, Bill Casey connection that happens right before this. So I think We can get back to that in volume two, but essentially promise, what that allowed is that it's sort of the beginning of using technology as a way of obtaining blackmail without having to set people up for sex blackmail, because you're getting a backdoor into people's computers. So the more dependent people become on technology, the more you can access illicit information about them, or information that can be used to control them, not necessarily illicit, but maybe an embarrassing secret or something like that. And you don't necessarily need people doing sex blackmail of yesteryear to control them, right? Huh. And so I talk about in the book how there were efforts by people, for example, involved in these networks, or BCCI and other things, seeking to financially blackmail a significant number of members of Congress. For example, there were, in this particular period in the 80s, and also the late 70s, there was a lot of interest in trying to blackmail Congress, not necessarily by sexual means, but, you know, by digital means. And so this expands significantly with the rise of big tech. It's no coincidence that you have Jeffrey Epstein, for example, in the early 2000s, courting very extensively the heads of the big tech companies, Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, Reid Hoffman, the Google co-founders, all hanging out at one point or another at Epstein's mansion, having dinner with him. So, and then, of course, you have Ghislaine Maxwell herself involved in a lot of functions with Silicon Valley venture capital. I would argue that's because, you know, as technology becomes more ubiquitous, not just congressmen, but everyone's secrets are online. So you get a backdoor into people's stuff, and you can blackmail whoever you want without having to invest the money in an elaborate sexual blackmail operation where you have to pay the blackmailer, pay off the local police. You have to maintain the luxurious residence. You have to maintain a sex trafficking operation to keep the women or girls that entice the men, or in some cases it's underage boys, depending on the persuasion of the person to be blackmailed. Right. So you essentially in the 1980s see the beginning of how blackmail begins to evolve over time. And at the center of it are people like Maxwell and Epstein. And so that's why I think a lot of my work on Epstein and the Maxwells with Bill Gates and Microsoft is pretty significant, because they were, just as Robert Maxwell's children after his death were trying to, in their own words, rebuild his legacy. They create a very significant tech company that gets in bed with Microsoft in a very significant way. Then you have, you know, Jeffrey Epstein in the late 90s going on official trips for Microsoft and all other sorts of weird stuff. Yeah. But if you believe mainstream media, Bill Gates didn't know who Jeffrey Epstein was until 2011. That's pretty interesting and unbelievable.
we get back to that in part two, but you're
trying to tease some of that to your audience.
Yeah, that's great. And the first book is packed. It's 500 goddamn pages. Now, we're going to obviously plug your sites and all these details later, but this is just part one, and it ends with the dark secrets of the Reagan era. So it starts with the underworld, 20s, 30s, ends in the 80s. And it's so much going on there that you needed 500 pages just for that part, the context, if you like.
Right. So the dark secrets of the Reagan era chapter, a lot of that is about, for example, Roy Cohn's influence in the Reagan administration, but also how the Reagan administration had a lot of connections through these networks I'm exploring in the book, and their outsized role, of course, in the Reagan administration are involved in a series of very scandalous pedophilia scandals. In this period. So one of them is Covenant House, which has, for example, a Bear Stearns overlap, an overlap with Southern Air Transport, and a Bush family related charity called AmeriCares, and all other sorts of crazy stuff. And then the other big one, of course, being the Franklin scandal, which involved the Republican Party, a major Republican fundraiser and rising star. And the Republican Party was exposed as using the credit union he was running in Nebraska as a front for a very elaborate child sex trafficking operation between Nebraska and Washington, D.C. His affiliate in that was a Washington-based lobbyist and self-described CIA agent named Craig Spence. and some of these children being trafficked were given midnight tours of the White House, among other things. And this was reported on in mainstream media, but of course, you know, is becomes largely forgotten about later in all the key witnesses in the Franklin scandal case. Once it's being investigated by Nebraska's state Congress, end up being pretty much all killed off. And then a private investigator is hired, and then his plane is blown up and his briefcase disappears from the scene of the wreckage, and all other, you know, all other sorts of crazy stuff goes on there. And the guy at the center of it, Larry King, who is the Republican fundraiser and former Raising Star, never went to prison. He's apparently still in Washington, D.C., running a car dealership now or something.
Not the CNN guy.
So these people all
right,
got,
right. So it's another Larry King.
Yeah, not the journalist. He's an African-American named Larry King. So totally okay. Different guy based in Nebraska. So, you know, a lot of this involved top people in the Reagan administration. Allegedly, one of the national security advisors, I think, for Vice President George W. Bush, Donald Gregg, was one of the people that allegedly officiated some of these White House visits of these rent boys or call boys, as they were called in the press at the time. But
yeah, but wasn't it CIA Bush who really ran that? I mean, the deal they struck with Reagan was that he's going to be there.
Sure, it's been alleged. Yeah, but as far as we know, you know, it's the most direct tie to Bush is through Donald Gregg, as it relates to this scandal. I mean, there's been claims, of course, that Bush was much more involved, right? And
yeah.
I don't necessarily say he wasn't, but unfortunately, the evidence isn't there to be like, yes, right, definitely. Right.
Yeah.
You know?
But it seems to me that Bush is the successor of Alan Dulles, basically.
Oh, and yeah, I think that's pretty probably fair. Yeah, in terms of the same level of corruption, though, I would argue that the Bush family has definitely gone far beyond Alan Dulles's wildest dreams in that sense. Because Alan Dulles never got into the presidency, right?
Nah, he seemed to be content with controlling.
He did get to murder a president, though.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And put in his stooge. But yeah. But I'm amazed. You know, I had no idea that the honey trap was elevated this early. You could say that the laptop has replaced the honey trap, but this early, as in.
Exactly.
That's amazing, man.
Yeah.
Okay, I guess you have to go now, right?
Yeah, but really quick, and we can talk about this more in our next conversation. So there is a direct line from the people we've been talking about today, specifically as it relates to the Promise software scandal, to the same people that essentially control the apparatus of mass surveillance in the U.S. and more broadly speaking, the Five Eyes countries and really the entire West is run by these same people. There's a direct line.
Did this start in the 80s?
It started in the 80s. It involves the Maxwell family essentially all the way through. So there's Promise and from Promise, you get a company called Kiliad, which involves the CIA's chief information officer with Christine Maxwell, Ghislaine Maxwell's sister, who worked at the front company used by Robert Maxwell to sell the Promise software stuff to national security agencies and nuclear labs in the U.S. And so it's this chief top CIA guy, her, creating Kiliad, which is essentially a successor to Promise. The reason they did this is because there was a lot of legal issues because the person who created Promise had it stolen from him and was in a lot of litigation with the U.S. government. So they wanted a product that could do essentially the same thing, but wouldn't be targeted by that litigation. And then Kiliad, the CIA guy involved with that, is intimately involved with the creation of Palantir, which is the big company that does all that stuff today. Yeah. And Palantir is, in my opinion, a CIA front company. It's seed funding from the CIA. The CIA essentially created and tweaked its companies to serve it. CEO Alex Karp has said that the original intended client of Palantir was the CIA, and the CIA was their only client for their first 3 or 5 years as a company. Right. And they still, of course, have a very close working relationship with them. And it's and at the time, the person that would have been involved in all of these efforts to tweak and manage their product is the same guy that co-founded Kiliad with Christine Maxwell. And then, of course, Palantir is the privatized effort by one of the Iran-Contra co-conspirators, John Poindexter. It was originally a public-private partnership pitched after 9/11 called Total Information Awareness that Poindexter was going to run, but it was considered too controversial and and then it's privatized and becomes Palantir. But Poindexter is essentially contacted after TIA is shut down by Alex Karp and Peter Thiel to guide them in how to create a private equivalent of TIA, which is what Palantir is. So there's a direct line between all the stuff. It's really crazy. But we'll talk more about that next time.
We will. And CIA has their tentacles into, we know already, Facebook, PayPal, and I believe also Twitter.
Of course. Yeah. All of it, really.
All of it. So we live in an Intel security military industrial state. I think the president warned us. He was onto it, but he should have lumped in the intelligence services there too, because they seem to be more a strategist, you know, behind most of the dealings, certainly in the past, and but even more so now, I think, with the, you know, the tech era. It's a two-edged sword. In one way, it served us well. We're having this conversation. We couldn't do this in the 80s, right? But on the other hand, it's also easier for them, as we're going to hear in part two. So, like I said, I call them vampires. So for the next part of the vampire saga, tune in after the break.
Okay, wonderful.
All of our files are free and will remain free. If you like the show, you can show support by donating $1 to help with expenses. Just use the PayPal link on our webpage. Thanks.